of reverse-engineered cultural imperialism represents. I like to think that by the turn of the century, Euro Disney will have become a deserted city, similar to Angkor Wat. The opening day attendance was just 6,000 people, far short of the projected 10,000. Although attendance through December reached 7 million, it fell off drastically during the cold weather. Unlike the Japanese, the French were not willing to wait in lines in the cold. Nice as the hotels were, few wanted to stay so far from Paris. Occupancy at the hotels was just 60%, far short of the projected 85%. Wells confided that he dreaded going to the fax machine every morning to get the previous day's Euro Disney attendance figures. More fundamentally, costs had so far exceeded projections that Euro Disney, now saddled with a staggering $3 billion in debt, would have had trouble earning a profit even under the most optimistic of assumptions. With the park open, Green returned to run the U.S. theme parks, and Bourguignon, a Frenchman, was named chairman and chief executive of the Euro Disney Resort. Frank Wells called Steve Burke every morning, and Burke tried to sound warnings, as did Bourguignon. But the message didn't seem to get through to Eisner, who continued to predict that the clouds over Euro Disney would disperse as soon as warmer weather boosted crowds and as Europe emerged from the recession that followed Iraq's invasion of Kuwait. Eisner was still intent on adding a second theme park to the site, a European version of the MGM Studios park in Orlando, and the Imagineers were hard at work. But early in 1993, Richard Nanula, the newly appointed chief financial officer, and Larry Murphy, head of strategic planning, who had consistently warned about overspending and optimistic assumptions, flew to Paris with a team from Disney to assess the financial health of the venture. It was even worse than Burke and Bourguignon had warned. Nearly all the assumptions Disney had made in the early projections and used to determine the budget had been wildly off base. Europeans' vacation habits were dramatically different from Americans, something that might have been anticipated had Disney relied on European data rather than projecting results from Disney World onto a European setting. For one thing, the average middle-class European had far more vacation time than did Americans. But this meant that they spent far less per day to make ends meet. They were not willing to stay in expensive hotels like the ones Disney had built, nor did they eat, drink, attend shows, or buy souvenirs at a rate anywhere near that of Americans. The hotel occupancy rate was less than 50%. Unlike Americans, 75% of Euro Disney's visitors booked their trips through travel agents. Most Americans called Disney directly to make reservations. The resulting agents' commissions that Disney was forced to pay made a dramatic dent on the bottom line. Given the cost structure, Euro Disney wasn't making money on an operating basis, let alone able to service its massive $3 billion debt. Warmer weather did not bring a dramatic improvement. Indeed, it was clear to Larry Murphy that under the most optimistic operating assumptions, Euro Disney would not make money. The situation was so dire that Disney was rapidly heading toward breaching its debt agreements, which could cause the banks and other major lenders to force the project into bankruptcy, an almost unthinkable embarrassment. Determined to force Eisner to face reality, Murphy insisted on